This is The Crossover, an NBA show hosted by Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
It's a whole new level for you and me, Chris, this relationship.
Like and subscribe for the best weekly NBA content these two are capable of.
What does that mean?
Could be the best duo ever.
I don't see how you can beat that.
Here they are, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck.
All right, crossover NBA podcast, Chris Mannix and Howard Beck. What up, Beck?
What's happening, Chris? I can't help but notice as we do this again, our weekly routine here, that you seem to have the same t-shirt on, the NBA Jam. All I can see is the NBA Jam. I can't see what's below it. Either you have 732 NBA Jam shirts of different colors and configurations, or you keep picking the same one up off the floor. I'm a little concerned. Our YouTube viewers might share my concern, so I just figured I should ask.
Well, I would say I have in excess of 15 NBA Jam t-shirts. Okay. I am wearing the one bearing the likeness of Waddell Stephen Curry on this jersey in honor of Steph potentially breaking the all-time record for three-pointers made as early as Wednesday. Steph is 16 three-pointers behind Ray Allen on the all-time list. There's some momentum, Howard, for Steph to break this record against the Blazers. It's the last game of a homestand for Golden State. If he doesn't break it on Wednesday night, they'll be on the road for the next five games. So, I think that's a bit of a stretch. Steph has not made more than 9 three-pointers in a game this season. The record, I believe, is 14 by Klay Thompson. So you're asking Steph to have a record-breaking performance to break a record on the all-time list.
I mean, it's Steph, so all things are possible. It's against the Blazers, so all things are possible. But Steph's personal high is 13 in a game. He's done that actually just once. He had 12 once as well. You're right, Clay, 14 back in 2018. I'm not going to predict a 16 three-point explosion in one game by Steph, but I'm not going to rule it out either. I think more likely he's going to get it on this upcoming road trip, which means it could come at Madison Square Garden, where he's had some historic nights. Could come in Indianapolis, where Reggie Miller once roamed, so symbolic value there. I guess the only thing we know for sure is it's coming soon, and that's going to be a really fun moment.
You know where it should happen? Minnesota, to make Minnesota once again suffer for not drafting Steph Curry. That's just mean. But whatever. They drafted 2 point guards ahead of him. They drafted Johnny Flynn and my man Ricky Rubio. I love Ricky Rubio, but you don't draft him over Steph Curry. Come on.
Timberwolves fans have suffered enough, and particularly over that draft. If you're going to do that, if you're going to be that cruel, it should at least be with David Kahn sitting there having to endure this whole thing in person himself, although that might not be a safe situation if that were in Minnesota.
Hey, the Timberwolves are playing good defense. So says our friend Michael Pina. Wrote a good column about that on SI.com, which is up today. All right, we're going to get into other topics, not necessarily the Timberwolves or Golden State. But I want to begin this show, Howard, talking about the ever-evolving situation between Damian Lillard and Portland in the aftermath of Neil Olshey being fired. The question has naturally turned to, what does that mean for Damian Lillard? Is he going to become a trade chip? Or are the Blazers and a new front office going to be more inclined to deal him? Now, there has been some reporting over the last couple of days about Damian Lillard's interest in playing with Ben Simmons, about his interest in a long-term extension with the team. For whatever it's worth, from Lillard's side, I'm told none of that's true, that Lillard has not expressed any interest in acquiring Ben Simmons, that since he's not eligible for a max extension yet, there haven't been those discussions either. So, there seems to be some disagreements on both sides between what is the case with Damian Lillard. Let me get your take on where things stand now, specifically with Lillard. I mean, we know that Olshey was let go by the Blazers as a result of what came out of this investigation into the hostile workplace. We don't know enough about it to really get too deep in the weeds because the Blazers are not releasing the results of the report. Olshay has not spoken on this yet, and it's still unclear if he's getting paid. I think he's owed around $20 million with what's left on his deal. It has not been determined, at least not publicly determined, if he's going to get paid for that. So we'll stay away from that side of it, at least for now, and just talk about kind of the future of Damian Lillard in the aftermath of this front office shakeup in Portland.
Yeah, and listen, I'm not going to say that they shouldn't have fired Neil Olshay because we don't know what exactly was in that investigation. We don't know what they found. We don't know whether there was a hostile workplace. How much of that is on Neil Olshay versus?
Can I just say? Let me just say one thing on this, Howard. I've written this before, so I don't mind obviously saying it on the podcast. One of the things that I've been told came out of this investigation was a lot of Neil was mean to me stuff. Like Neil could be, can be a very abrasive guy. He has a temper, and that manifested itself with some somewhat ugly exchanges with staffers within that organization. Those staffers told their stories to the investigators. I don't believe that there is some, again, any boorish behavior is bad behavior, but I don't know if there's any, one smoking gun that was attached to this. There was just a lot of those types of stories that were fed to investigators that I think ultimately led to that decision.
And so based on that, right, so this may be fully justified, right, based on non-basketball stuff. You could also justify it based on the basketball. You could say, hey, look, he had a long run, longer than most GMs get in their positions, and they've plateaued. We need new direction, new whatever. Like, whether it was a basketball decision in some part, whether it was purely because this investigation is almost immaterial, but where they are right now is a very difficult and, dangerous spot. This is the last, this is the worst possible time, among the worst possible times, for a franchise to be rudderless or to have a leadership vacuum at the top of basketball ops. And I'm not saying that means that they shouldn't have fired him. Again, we don't know what the total causes were and what percentage was basketball versus other stuff. I would just say that given where they are in the standings, given all the smoke surrounding their situation, possible trades of McCollum for Ben Simmons or somebody else, possible trades of Damian Lillard, Lillard's in this slump, Chauncey Billups early in his coaching career is certainly struggling to get this team on course. This is not a great time to be to have a vacuum at the top of your basketball ops. And I don't know when they're going to replace him. Are they going to wait till after the season? Does Joe Cronin, who stepped in as interim, is he fully empowered to pick a direction? Because they're at an inflection point right now, and there's a potential opportunity out there. Whether Dame Lillard does or doesn't want to play with Ben Simmons, whether he has or has not expressed that to somebody, which then leaked out in a report in The Athletic recently, the bottom line is Ben Simmons is available. We know that much is certain. And we know that Ben Simmons next to Damian Lillard, you and I agree, that would immediately improve this Trailblazers team. And a CJ McCollum-based package that you and I have discussed many times seems like a potentially viable way to go. So I want, if I'm the Portland Trailblazers, I want somebody that I truly trust to make important basketball decisions in that job. But right now they are in flux. So the timing is terrible. And I'll be very curious to see where they go from here. Are they prepared to make a dramatic move? Maybe not trading Lillard himself, but trading McCollum, or maybe trading Nurkic, maybe trading some of these other pieces. If you're going to snap them out of this funk, it's going to require some moves. And I don't know what if you do that with an interim head of basketball ops or not. I'll be curious to see how they play this out.
Yeah, I can't see Joe Cronin being empowered to trade Damian Lillard. Not this year, and not until, if it happens, Joe Cronin is named the permanent president of basketball operations. They're obviously going to cast a pretty wide net in Portland to try to see who the best fit is for that franchise. I think that choice, be it Joe Cronin or anybody else, should be the person empowered with that decision. But I do think Cronin can and should explore secondary deals. And by that, I mean CJ McCollum. Again, regardless of what Lillard wants, Simmons for McCollum makes sense for both teams, right? You got Ben Simmons just hanging out in Philadelphia with clearly no intention of ever playing for that franchise. He's there. You put Ben Simmons in Portland, all of a sudden, you have added a Swiss Army knife type of defender to one of the worst defensive teams in the league. And you add another ball handler, an up-tempo guy, who can, you know, obviously energize that team's fast-break attack. That makes sense for Portland. CJ McCollum makes a ton of sense for the Philadelphia 76ers. I mean, Joel Embiid, and we'll get to this, is having a monster season in Philadelphia. They have Seth Curry playing well, Tobias Harris, when he's healthy, playing well. They need more firepower. CJ McCollum, while not being Damian Lillard, represents firepower. That to me is an obvious swap to make if both teams can kind of narrow their focus and not try to extract every ounce of blood being draft picks in this context, from the other in this situation. The other part of this, Howard, the extension that Lillard is eligible for this offseason. I don't think it's a leap of faith to say that Lillard wants that extension. That would guarantee him an extra $100 million and two more years on his deal that will take him right up until around his 37th birthday. That kind of guaranteed money, if it's available to you, you are going to want it. The question becomes, does it make any sense for Portland to do it? I know what Lillard's brought to that team. He has been the face of that franchise for almost a decade now. I think you and I are on the same page. He is arguably the greatest Blazer of all time. Like, he's right there atop that list. But I don't feel like you could be nostalgic in these situations, because right now, Lillard is a very marketable player. Even though he's struggling this year and dealing with injuries, he is still, at 31 years old, at the proverbial peak of his powers. You can trade him and get a huge return back for him. Next offseason, if Lillard kind of, you know, plays this year, not quite the level he played the last couple of years, and you give him two more years, does he become quite as appealing? I know teams want players on long contracts, so they don't have to deal with, you know, the potential free agency and losing them. But does Lillard being guaranteed like 50 plus million per year over the last 2 years of his deal, does that make him more marketable to you? Like, I don't think so. I haven't had this conversation with too many executives, but the sense I get is that he's kind of exactly where he needs to be contract-wise. After this season, there are three more years left on that deal. That's plenty of time for a team that acquires him to figure out how to win with him, and not too much time that you start to worry about, oh my God, how do we get this guy off our books later in his career? So that to me, like, regardless of what Lillard wants now, what's been conveyed now, the Blazers will have, if Lillard's still on the roster come July, they're going to have a very, very tough decision to make when it comes to the future of Damian Lillard.
All right, so let's just some perspective here, because current NBA salaries for superstars, max contracts, everything are so far off the scales now because of they're all tied to basketball related income, right? And the NBA business is still booming. And so it's hard to get our heads around now things like Steph Curry. And I don't want to compare Steph and Dame because they're different players. There are some similarities, obviously, as well. But I'm using Steph as the example only to say this. He became the second player ever to sign a second $200 million contract when he signed this extension over the summer. And in Steph's case, and Steph's a little older than Dame, Steph is going to be making $60 million, 6-0, in the last year of that deal, I believe, when he's about 38. It's kind of the cost of doing business if you have a superstar in this league. We've seen it with Chris Paul, too. At a certain point, you have to simply make peace with the fact that when you have an all-timer, a Hall of Famer, a top 75er in the case of Steph Curry and Chris Paul and Dame Lillard, for that matter, somebody who defines your franchise, somebody who has brought incredible value to your franchise, somebody who has thrilled your fans, who has made you competitive, who has made you relevant, who has made you fun and entertaining, you just deal with it. And you know, it's harder in a small market like Portland. Obviously, Golden State, like, you know, those guys freaking print money, especially with their new arena. It's not the same in Portland. And there is risk that comes with it. But I'm going to sign him first and worry about that later because of how much he's meant. And he is the greatest trailblazer of all time.
You would give him the extension.
If he asks for it next summer, Chris, yeah, I'm going to do it. Now, that presupposes a few things, like he's not, no serious injuries between now and then, and that this funk that he's in there in the early part of the season works its way out. He's only 31. The guys' primes are extended in this era. We've seen it. And it's not across the board. You know, everybody's body is different. But look at what Chris Paul's doing at his age. Look what Steph Curry is still doing. Look what LeBron has done. It's a different time. And, you know, so we have to recalibrate some of our expectations. And again, if you're the franchise that's fortunate enough to have a generational type talent like Steph, or in this case, like Damian Lillard, I think you do what you got to do. We don't know if he's asking for that extension. We don't know if he will. We don't know if he'll want the max value on it, or if he'll insist on that, or if he'll give them some wiggle room. But if and when that moment comes, I'm doing it. And I'm, by the way, I'm not trading him. I am not proactively trading Damian Lillard. If I'm the Portland Trailblazers, I know I'm a small market. I do not attract free agents. And getting a guy like Dame, who they drafted sixth overall, credit to Neil O'Shea for that pick, by the way, like that is some combination of good fortune and good scouting, but you don't get that opportunity every year. You can go years, decades. Ask the Sacramento Kings how long it might take to find a talent who can anchor your team and how difficult that is, especially in a smaller market. So I am not about to pull the plug on the Dame Lillard era when he's still just 31 years old. I'm looking to trade, whether it's CJ McCollum, Nurkic, Covington, Powell, basically everybody else. And I think they're all movable. What you can get is a different question. They are overdue for a shakeup, no question. If I can get Ben Simmons, I'm with you. I'm going and getting him. But short of that, I'm still trying to make other moves to support Dame Lillard and extend their this Lillard era of being a strong playoff team as opposed to starting over and trading him.
It's not an unreasonable argument. I just, maybe I'm a little bit more practical, cold-blooded, whatever word or phrase you want to use. I don't see this team...
Panicky?
No, it's not panicky. Like, I don't see this team winning a championship in the next couple of years. And if you're not, well, what are you playing for? If you're not playing for a championship, you should be tearing it down to build something that eventually will compete for a championship. And you know, you talked about how the shelf life of players is even longer in today's game. And like, I believe that. Like, I get that. It's, you know, whether it's the amount of members on a training staff and what guys are able to do, their bodies hold up a little bit longer in today's game. But a couple things worry me about Lillard. One, he has been an Iron Man for most of his career. You look at the games played here. 18-19, he played 80 games. 19-20, the bubble season, he played 66 games. Last season, played 67 of 72. So he has been a workhorse for this team, all while averaging 36 minutes, 37 minutes, 36 minutes. Like, he's right around 36, 37 minutes per game every single year. And the last 6 months have given me a little bit of reason for pause with Damian Lillard, where you've had the Olympic experience, which wasn't great for him. Like, he didn't play all that well for Team USA. Had his moments, but didn't play all that well for Team USA. Now you start this season, and the numbers have slid a little bit. And you have him dealing with some nagging injuries, the abdominal injury. I worry that all that Damian Lillard has had to do to carry this team for as long as he's had to, that it's starting to catch up with him a little bit. And look, you're already locked in on him for 3.5 more years. Like, he's your guy for that long. Adding 2 years to that contract where he'll be age 35 in one of those seasons and age 36 in the next season, that to me feels like a pretty big risk. Your argument's fine that, you know, he's the face of the franchise and all that, and I think it's a little bit too much nostalgia for me, but I get it. But like, if Damian Lillard had 1 year left in his contract and wanted two more, I'd say go for it. But he's got 3.5. Like he's got a lot of time left in this contract. If I'm Portland, I'd want to see what happens in the next year, 2 years before I offer Damian Lillard another extension.
Well, I want to see what happens in the next year, 2 years after I've retooled the roster before I just decide to pull the plug and trade him and trade the best player in franchise history.
But is it even, Howard, is it even about trading him? Like, you don't have to trade him. Like, you just don't have to extend him. Like, if you go into next season and say, he's not an expiring contract. Like,
They're two different. They're two different decisions, though, right? Like, if he asks for the extension next summer, and you just say, "Listen, we'd like to let this run a little while longer first," he might not be happy about it, but he'll live with it. It'll be fine, I think. So, hopefully, you're splitting the difference here. You're not trading him immediately because I think it's too soon to do that. And no, I don't necessarily want to extend him immediately next summer. I do kind of want to see where things shake out in the meantime, but. The bottom line is I want to move forward with Damian Lillard if I'm the Portland Trailblazers. I am not trading him unless he comes to me and says, I want out. And if he did, I would say, listen, is there any way to talk you back into staying? No? Okay. You have meant so much to this franchise and this city. We're going to do right by you, and we will try to move you to, you know, a place that you'd prefer to be. And then you hope to extract maximum value from that team, and you start over and you start a new era. Hopefully you're getting a player or picks that turn into the player that can then anchor your next era. But the bottom line is trying to find another Damian Lillard is going to be a steep task, and I'm not rushing to do that, especially when he is still in his prime at 31, when I've got movable pieces around him that I think I can use in a retool. And I also, you know, for a market like Portland, I don't think we should judge them based on this rings or bust mentality. They have been one of the best teams over the last 7-8 years, consistently in the playoffs. They have been an entertaining team. They have given their fans endless thrills. Dame Lillard has put butts in seats and kept that building full and given fans something to cheer for. And that's part of this game, too. Only one team wins a championship every year. And in this league, with dynasties and everything else, not that many teams even win a championship in a 10 or 20 year span. The next best thing you can be, if you're not a champion, is to have an incredible player and great teams that are worth seeing, that are fun and relevant. And the Blazers have been that. So if it's championship or bust, then a lot of teams should be tearing down all the time and giving up on whatever they have. No, I'm not ready to give up on Dame Lillard in Portland.
I don't know if that part of it is true. I mean, I think the Blazers are just at, as you pointed out, an inflection point. Like, they have a roster that feels kind of stale and no... I mean, they can shake things up and should shake things up, I think, before the deadline with a deal that involves either McCollum or Nurkic or somebody else and see what you have there. But you're right. Only one team wins a championship, Howard, but two teams make the finals. The Blazers never done that during the Lillard era. Four teams make the conference finals. Blazers have done that once in the Lillard era. So making the playoffs and getting beat in the first round or the second round, that's worth it? To me, it's not. And that's just kind of how I sort of approach things there. What I think, honestly, Howard, like what I think needs to happen is whenever the Blazers hire a top executive, be it in season or after this one, that executive will need to have a frank conversation. Like, they got to sit down and be like, look, what do you want? Like, you see what we are. You see what we can do. Like, is being here and getting paid enough for you? Or, you know, do you want to spend the last few years of your prime trying to compete for a championship? If that's the case, we'll work with you. Like, Lillard's not going to get traded to, like, Oklahoma City. Like, they're not just going to dump him someplace. They'll work with him on a trade partner. And that may be the best of both worlds. Because let's say Lillard gets traded to the Knicks. I think the Knicks would happily give him that extension that he wants and pay him for the foreseeable future. And Lillard at MSG would be pretty, not to be... not to have too much alliteration here, but be good, must-see TV, you know, in New York. So I think that conversation needs to take place. Lillard, his agent, the new GM, president, whatever it is, talking this thing out and figuring out what's best for everybody, because it still feels like this is kind of a disjointed group out there.
Yes, in the moment it is. And the Blazers, as we, you know, we agree, they're at an inflection point, and they're at a potentially very delicate point with the direction of this entire franchise and Lillard's future there. And I agree that those discussions need to happen. But yeah, first things first, they need to get a permanent head of basketball ops in place. I don't think you want to ride out a season like if they were just on cruise control, if they were at a different point in their trajectory, I would be all in favor of, like, you know, let the season ride out, see how things go, and then figure out your new team GM or president or whatever after the season. I think if there's somebody out there that you can identify, and I know it's tougher during the season, you got to get permission from teams when you're interviewing somebody's number two or whatever, but do it now. Get this done soon. Get somebody in there that ownership trusts and that Dame Lillard can also, and his team, his representation can put their faith in, and then have those discussions. But whoever that person is, my number one goal is keeping Damian Lillard. And I'm going to do everything possible, retool around him. This is not a team that is full of a bunch of, like, old crumbling players who are on immovable contracts. They got a bunch of guys who are still young or in their prime on reasonable deals. All of them are movable. They're not stuck by any stretch. Whether they can meaningfully move forward by flipping some of these pieces, that remains to be seen. But they have by no means reached the end of their road when it comes to trying to rebuild or build around Damian Lillard. There is still a potential for a contender with Lillard as their centerpiece.
So sentimental, Howard. You're so sentimental.
It's not sentiment. He's a great player. You should not give up great players unless you have to.
That actually brings me to another point with Ben Simmons and the Sixers. Like, do you look at the situation in Philadelphia? Like, are they... Do they owe it to Joel Embiid to do something here? Like, to not let this season kind of slip away from them? I mean, they're fine right now. As we record this, they're 13-11. They're seventh in the Eastern Conference. But Embiid is playing like a monster at the moment. Like, he had 43 points against Charlotte on Monday night. He's been posting big-time double-doubles every single night. He's averaging on the season about 24 points per game, pulling down 11 rebounds. Like, he's been awesome. Like, do they not owe it to Joel Embiid to do something? I mean, look, we talk about Portland, and would they do McCollum for Simmons, a McCollum-Simmons swap? Like, if you're Philadelphia, I know you probably want Damian Lillard, and you want to protect the asset that is Ben Simmons if that option's still on the table, but if you have a chance to get CJ McCollum, I think CJ McCollum instantly upgrades Philadelphia into 1A or 1B in the Eastern Conference. Like, I think McCollum's that good and would be that solid a fit alongside Embiid that if you can get CJ McCollum and you're Philadelphia, don't you have to jump at that?
I mean, listen, CJ McCollum certainly better than having just Ben Simmons' contract but not Ben Simmons. And I like CJ McCollum a lot, and I think he'd be great with Joel Embiid. You know, there are concerns about, like, okay, you may have an undersized backcourt again, and McCollum's not going to help your defense at all, or traditionally has not. So, like, it's not a slam dunk. It's not an automatic. But is he a good fit? Yes. Is he certainly an upgrade over having just the ghost of Ben Simmons? Yes. I don't know what. Listen, I don't know what there is out there that's a better deal. I don't know who the better fit would be. I always loved the idea of Bradley Beal there. Again, somebody who doesn't necessarily play defense, but at least has even higher offensive ceiling than McCollum does. But Beal's not available. It doesn't appear that he will be anytime soon. To your point, Joel Embiid, you do have an obligation to him. He'll be 28 in March, and dude is on a tear. So since coming back from his long COVID absence, as we record this, the last five games averaging 28.5 points, 14.5 rebounds, 5 assists, which is fantastic because Embiid at times in his career has not been much of a playmaker, but 5 assists a game over the last 5, and 1.8 blocks a game over that stretch as well, while shooting almost 43% from 3. He's been a monster, and you don't want to waste a year of his prime. You don't want to waste any part of Joel Embiid's prime. So there is some urgency, Chris. Like, I'm not going to say that there's none, but you mentioned the place in the standings. Yeah, they're 13-11. They're tied for sixth in the East, technically. They're 2 losses out of third. Like, yeah. They're 2 lost, 2 back in the loss column from third place in the East. So they're okay.
Yeah, but isn't that like an argument for making it? Like,
oh, sure.
The East is fairly open. Like, Brooklyn has Kevin Durant, but they've got, you know, whatever, 75% of James Harden, and unless something dramatically changes, no Kyrie Irving. So
yeah, 0% of Kyrie.
There's an opening here.
Right.
There's an opening here.
There's an opening. yeah, let's not look past the Bucks, but the Bucks also have lost Brook Lopez.
Of course not.
The Bucks have lost Brook Lopez, a key piece for possibly the season. I mean, I know that they're just saying
back
indefinitely, but
real.
It's back surgery, like on a 7-footer. So I do think there's an opening, and I do think that the Sixers post Ben Simmons trade, whatever that trade brings back, could absolutely be a contender the next day. The day they make that trade, they could be a contender depending on what they get. I don't think it's like in serious urgency right now on December 7th. However, the window is coming, right? December 15th is when you can trade guys who were signed over the summer league-wide. So a lot more guys become available to make trades and multiplayer trades. February 10th is the trade deadline. So here's our window. If we're going to talk about when it's urgent for the Sixers, because I don't think you want to finish the season with the Ben Simmons stalemate hanging over you still. So the window is about to open on December 15th. That's when if you want to talk about urgency, that's when I will buy into the idea of urgency. From December 15th to February 10th, the trade deadline. There's your window. That's when you got to get something done and resolve the situation and put Embiid and this team back in position to be true contenders.
Yeah. I just hate to see another season, a healthy season, wasted for Joel Embiid.
Like, agreed.
The guy's a monster. Watching him out there is remarkable. And I do think, like, I understand, I think the Sixers did the right thing early on asking for the moon for Ben Simmons. You shouldn't be bullied into doing a deal for a player of that caliber. But if CJ McCollum is on the table and you can get a first-round draft pick sweetener along with it, I think you got to do it. I think McCollum is good enough. He's not Lillard, but I think McCollum puts the Sixers right into that top tier in the Eastern Conference, and that's a pretty good place to be. So that's my two cents on it. Sticking with the Eastern Conference for a minute, what's going on with the Knicks? What are we doing here? I mean, I kind of want to scrub from the internet that video victory lap I made early in the season on this podcast, screaming to everybody that I told you the Knicks were going to be better this year than they were last year. Better in terms of one loss record. I was astonished at the over-under that the Knicks had of 41.5 when I was in Vegas a little while back. Since then, there's been a serious regression in New York. You've got Julius Randle not playing like the player we saw last year. RJ Barrett in a huge shooting slump. The defense, top three in the NBA last season, has fallen to the bottom third of the NBA this season. Where do you want to start? Here, Howard. Where have things gone wrong with the Knicks? And the most important question is, how much of it is fixable?
You know, it's as you're going down that list, I was trying to think, like, where's the, you know, look, there's always a silver lining here. It's hard to find anything that's really going right with them. Like, it's like, well, at least there's X, right? And I guess the at least there's X is that Obi Toppin has looked pretty good and is showing, you know, some really nice potential there, to the point where I think Knicks fans are ready to throw all their other bigs overboard and make him the permanent starter playing 48 minutes a game at center. But other than that, like, really, everybody has regressed, and as a group, they clearly have. I mean, you will recall when we were making that video and then those podcasts talking about the Knicks early on, I had said my concern for the Knicks from the start this season was they had a magical run last year, a breakthrough year that nobody saw coming, and they did overachieve. Even internally, the Knicks understand they overachieved. And my worry was this has set them up for failure because fans and possibly ownership, which is less than sophisticated on basketball matters, might believe that this is now step one toward whatever, title contention, whatever. Like, this is like, you're like, this is it. We're here and we're here to stay, and there's only an upside from here. But it was potentially and now seems to be illusory in the sense that it was a weird season. There were no fans in buildings. A bunch of teams that were affected by COVID that should have been better than the Knicks were on paper fell behind them. And so I said from the beginning, my concern this season was, yes, they look better on paper, but they might be worse in the standings. And I think that expectations have been set unreasonably high now. That's where we are now, although they're certainly playing worse than I would have anticipated. I agreed they were at least better on paper. But the Kemba gambit has not worked out. I don't know if we want to say that it did not work out. I'll just say it has not worked out to date. But he's out of the rotation, and I don't know that that's going to change. So my concern is this. There's nothing about what's going on with the Knicks right now that seems to me to be fluky, right? There's nothing unexpected here. Julius Randle regressing some from last season, people thought that might happen. You know, he shot 40% from three for the first time in his career and became a much more efficient player all the way around, a bigger, better playmaker. Everybody wondered at the time, okay, is this permanent or is this a product of this strange season? Is this just a one-off? You know, how do you know what's real and what's just the product of this strange season? So you didn't know if he could replicate that. RJ Barrett made a big step forward last season. You hope for a young player that's just going to continue, but young players, it's rarely that linear. So RJ Barrett doesn't look like that great right now. Maybe he snaps out of it. Maybe this is just one of those kind of plateau years, and next year he makes the next leap. But right now, obviously, RJ Barrett's not looking that good. And those were guys who were key to the Knicks' renaissance last season. In the meantime, you swapped out a defensive backcourt for an offensive backcourt, and Kemba and Fournier obviously have not delivered offensively to make up for their defensive deficiencies. So it's looking more and more like last season was a fluke in some sense, that they were able to take advantage of strange circumstances across the league. No fans in buildings and a bunch of other teams that were affected by COVID and injuries underachieving, and so they leapfrogged a bunch of teams that on paper were probably better than them. And it's not to dismiss the season. It was a fantastic season, but there was always a legitimate question about whether it was sustainable. And I think the early results here suggest it was not. They have, two guys at center who are always hurt. You knew that coming in with Noel and Mitchell Robinson. It's been the problem again. The third person there is Taj Gibson, who's got a lot of miles on him. I mean, you're not going to get, all-star versions, flashback versions of Derrick Rose every night either. So there was just a lot that broke right that is now breaking wrong. And I don't know how you fix it.
The Barrett drop-off is tough, especially when you look at the three-point numbers. He shot 40% from three last season. He's down to around 30% this year. That's a huge, huge plummet. And I'm sure there are a lot of reasons, but from what I was told, Barrett's one of those guys that right now is having a little bit of trouble adjusting the new ball. There's a lot of those guys out there, Howard, that are having some issues with the grip on that new basketball. What I was told by one coach was that because the ball hits the rim differently and bounces differently, guys are adding a little bit more arc to their shots. They're literally changing their shots because of the composition of the basketball. And that's been screwing around with some guys. We've seen some shooting percentages drop, whether it was Damian Lillard, who we talked about. Jason Tatum's had some problems. RJ Barrett now, just to go down the list. So his decline has been problematic for New York. But you touched on it. Like, you go from top three defense to 22nd. This is what you get. Like, this is what you are right now. I mean, the Knicks, they won last season, not necessarily because Julius Randle was all NBA, but because they stopped guys, teams, every single night. They played like an old-school Tom Thibodeau defensive team. And this year, they're not. And whether it's a question just of the swap out of the backcourt, I mean, who would have thought they'd miss Reggie Bullock and Elfrid Payton this much? Like those guys apparently were big difference makers. Evan Fournier can't defend. Kemba Walker can't defend. They're having problems in that regard. And if they don't clean that up, this is going to be their team. Like, I think they can survive Randle being like 75-80% of what he was last year. They could even survive RJ Barrett being a little bit better than what he is right now. They can't survive. They can't defend. Like, they can't. Like, that was everything to them last season. They're giving up. They're getting gashed the way they've been getting gashed this season. They're in a lot of trouble the rest of this year. I don't know if there's a quick fix. In fact, I know there's not. Because if you're the Knicks, you're still taking a long-term view of this franchise, right? Like, you know, RJ Barrett, you hope he becomes a star for you, but if not for you, you hope he becomes somebody another team wants, that you can trade someone or trade him to get another star player back in return. We all know and have heard about the Knicks' interest in Damian Lillard over the years. They've been hot after him at various times. So you want Barrett to be an appealing trade chip. So I just think that they have to keep finding ways to improve internally. Like, there's nothing out there that's going to make them this, you know, upper half of the Eastern Conference team.
No. And by the way, if Lillard does become available, you know, and, you know, one, if Lillard's available, I think he's being traded for Ben Simmons. If he's not being traded for Ben Simmons.
You think, really? You think that, well, like, I don't know, I'd hold out for more if I'm Portland. Like, McCollum, okay, well, that I'd give him up for Ben Simmons. Like, you know, anybody else.
Fair. I mean, listen, the negotiations between the Blazers and Sixers on a Lillard-Simmons swap about who has to throw in more would get interesting very quickly. Obviously, if you're the Blazers, you're saying absolutely you've got to throw in much more because Lillard is top 75 all time and Ben Simmons is, you know, a really great talent.
Still who damaged goods.
Who won't
still
shoot, right? Goods. Yeah, no. There, no question. That's an interesting dance. On the other hand, Ben Simmons is younger. As you've pointed out, Lillard could have this massive contract extension that takes him through 37. Like, there are all these other considerations that start to come into play. But anyway, put that to the side for a minute. If Lillard becomes available, the Knicks are not, I don't think, anywhere near the front of the line because, you know, if we were talking a year ago, at least you could be advertising and touting the best possible version of RJ Barrett as a key piece in a trade. What are you touting now? Who are you sending that the Blazers possibly want? And, you know, there was this talk of their surplus of picks. They had two extra picks from the Porzingis trade, which we should come back to that in a minute. They had two extra picks. They've already used one of them. They did the picks. They swapped picks with the Clippers on draft night. So they end up with, his name is escaping me for the moment. I'm looking it up. Quentin Grimes they end up with. And they've got one more pick coming. So they've got all their own picks and they've got one extra, a future, you know, pick from Dallas in 2023 that's top 10 protected. It's not like they have a ton of picks to give up for Lillard. I mean, they can. I mean, you know, obviously, they could throw in all of them if they wanted to. It's not like they have a massive surplus. They're not the Oklahoma City Thunder. But where are the young players that the Blazers would certainly ask for? And is RJ Barrett, you know, captivating enough? I just don't know that that's the case. And besides that, is a Lillard-Randall partnership, is that putting you in contention in the Eastern Conference? I mean, I'm not sure I'm seeing that either. The real issue here is the defense, right? Like, Tom Thibodeau is a defensive coach. We know that. That's his rep. That's what he does. That's what he hangs his hat on and that his teams thrive on at their best. The Knicks were, whatever it was, top five last season?
Three.
They were third. They're 22nd at the moment. And we're deep enough into the season that we're kind of at that who you are is who you are phase. Like, maybe they're not as bad as 22nd in defense, but are they really going to jump up to top 10 after this kind of start? I'm not sure I see it.
You know, we mentioned Barrett. Like, Barrett is one of the few guys that's keeping them from becoming absolutely deplorable defensively. Like, you look up their defensive numbers when he's off the floor, it's historically bad. Like, yeah. They are historically bad defensively when RJ Barrett isn't playing. So he might be the only guy out there at this point that's playing high-level defense.
And so this brings me back to something that I've always, this is a discussion I have with people off and on over the years, which is, you know, is being a great defense really about coaching and scheme and emphasis, or is it about personnel? Because I always say these things come back to personnel. It doesn't matter how much
Tibbs. Ask the Lakers.
Yeah.
Ask the Lakers.
Right. Doesn't matter how great of a defensive coach Frank Vogel is, or certainly was when they were an elite defense the last couple of years. But when you trade all your defenders away and get back Russell Westbrook, then Frank Vogel suddenly doesn't look like a very, very good defensive coach anymore. Similarly, Tom Thibodeau was a great defensive coach as Doc's top assistant in Boston and for most of his run in Chicago. But Tibbs wasn't a defensive genius during his time in Minnesota. They were bottom third of the league in defense his whole time there. And we said, well, that's because it's Karl-Anthony Towns' fault and it's Andrew Wiggins' fault and some. And this is not to say that this means that Tibbs is not a great defensive coach. It just means that he, like everybody else, is beholden to his personnel. And the Knicks had just enough in the defensive department last season to be an elite defense. In year two, with slightly different personnel, and Bullock gone, and Elfrid Payton, who the fans hated, but Tibbs kept rolling him out there because the guy defended. He wasn't going to make a shot, but he defended. The bottom line is that a coach is never a cure-all. Especially this idea that a defensive coach makes you a great defense. No. Great defensive players make you a great defense. And the Knicks don't have that right now. And again, that's not changing. And banishing Kemba Walker from the rotation a quarter of the way into the season and promoting Alec Burks, I get it. And Burks has certainly given them a shot in the arm offensively, but it's not going to change the fact that you're a bottom third defensive team. And look, I'm just going to throw this out there now. I alluded to this a minute ago with the Porzingis trade. Not getting fair value or enough value for Porzingis and Tim Hardaway Jr. is now coming back to haunt them. I know some fans loved it because partially because they picked up Randall that summer and Randall became all NBA last year. I'm not sure if Randall's even going to make the All-Star team this year at the present rate, but we'll see. They had cap room regardless, by the way. They could have signed Julius Randle regardless, so they didn't need to make this trade to do that. But the bottom line is this. Here's what they got back to recall. Wes Matthews, DeAndre Jordan, they let them both walk immediately. I think they actually even waived Matthews, and then DeAndre Jordan left in free agency. Dennis Smith Jr. was supposed to be the key piece in that deal as a young, still prospect-ish player, and those three guys are all gone. So they didn't get back any players of value, and the picks were the 2021 first, which they traded down a few spots with the Clippers and picked up Quentin Grimes. We'll see what he becomes. He was the 25th pick. They have a future first 2023 that's top 10 protected from Dallas. And that's it. And I know they flipped Dennis Smith Jr. and a second for Derrick Rose. But, I mean, they could have. Dennis Smith Jr. was just a warm body to flip for Derrick Rose. The Pistons were going to trade him regardless. All you had to do was throw in somebody. It's not like Dennis Smith Jr. was the key to getting Derrick Rose. So let's not be delusional about that. That's silly. So really, they don't have anything to show for a guy who was a young all-star at the time in Porzingis and Tim Hardaway Jr., who, while overpaid, was a valuable rotation guy who's been a great sixth man for the Mavs and part-time starter for them. They didn't really get anything back for those guys other than, at the moment, Quentin Grimes and a future first. And so there's just not a lot there right now to fall back on. And that's part of it. It's not the most important piece of this, but it's there.
Yeah. I find funny, as you mentioned, that is how often we hear arguments from Mavericks fans and Knicks fans about who won that trade. Like neither side really won it. Like Porzingis is as frustrating as ever in Dallas. Like there's still plenty of questions about whether he's the appropriate number two to alongside Luka Doncic.
Absolutely. And he's always hurt, which is an issue. So I've never made the argument, to be clear, that the Knicks should have just kept him and paid him the max. I don't even think that the Mavs should have paid him the max. But the Knicks had other options, and they rushed into that deal.
I remember Howard at the time, like getting text messages from team executives, like expressing surprise that deal happened. Like they hadn't even heard he was available. Like they hadn't. Yes. Yeah, the Knicks should have canvassed the league, I think, a little bit more before they made that deal. Maybe they would have come up with the same deal. I don't know, but
and he was a restricted free agent that summer. Yeah.
Yeah, and we're still on the idea that he wasn't going to sign a max contract. These guys always sign max contracts when they're available to.
Right, he was not going to play out. Right, he was not going to take the qualifying offer and play it out and walk and all that bullshit.
Yeah. With his injury history, he's going to take the Okay, yeah, good one.
No, and so that's the thing. Like, I would never make the argument that they should have just kept him because I thought he was going to be a superstar. Like, it's like no, you have to maximize an asset, and he was at that time 24 years old and a recent All-Star.
I agree.
Albeit coming off of an ACL injury, but they didn't gauge the market. They made the first deal that they could get. They rushed him out the door. They could have waited until the summer. They could have seen how restricted free agency played out for him and then just matched and kept him and traded him later. They had all these other ways to play it. They rushed into a deal that got them nominal players, none of whom made an impact for them at all, and two late firsts. And by the way, Tim Hardaway Jr. was a sixth man of the year candidate last season. You know, I mean, not a high one, but he was among them. So it was actually two starter slash rotation guys for nothing except for a couple of late firsts. Like it was not a good deal in terms of value. And while it was a cap clearing kind of deal also, they already had cap room. The reason they needed to make that deal was because they wanted double max cap room because they thought they were getting Durant and Kyrie, not Randall and Taj Gibson and, you know, whoever else they got.
A little bit different than the projected outcome. I want to finish with something, Howard, that was floated to me this week. And I used the question, in my mailbag, which is up on SI.com right now. I never even thought about this till the person tweeted the question at me. I'm going to kind of paraphrase it here. Like, if you're LeBron James and you could right now decide which team to spend the next 5 years with, Cleveland or the Lakers? Like, based on their roster composition. No, I'm serious. Like, based on their roster composition. Like,
yeah.
What team, what roster offers you the best chance to win a championship? Now, your reflexive answer, the reflexive answer, would be the Lakers because Anthony Davis is there.
And
that's true. He's the second best player besides LeBron on either one of these teams. But you go over and look at Cleveland, and what do they do right now? They are top five in the NBA defensively. They've got baby Anthony Davis in Evan Mobley there. You've got Darius Garland, who has become, in my opinion, at least a candidate for All-Star, if not an All-Star himself, this season. Jared Allen and Mobley play well together in that front court. Got some interesting... Kevin Love is still there, and I got to believe LeBron will be able to extract even more out of Kevin Love if he were around. It got me thinking, like, you know, like, all right, well, the Lakers are the Lakers, and there's AD, and there's some big names, and all the Hall of Famers, and all that stuff, but I don't know, man. If I'm LeBron and I could just blindly choose one or the other, I might take Cleveland for what they have going for it right now. Am I crazy?
Oh, man. This question's brutal. It's brutal because it's true. Like,
it is.
The Cavs are actually better positioned for the next 5 years and beyond, probably.
How wild is that? Like, I know they've stunk it up the last couple of years.
Well, all right, but look, and listen, I'm not about to start defending anything that the Lakers have done personnel-wise, especially this past offseason, but I mean, to an extent, this is the way it's supposed to go, right? The Lakers are a team that recently won the championship, and they're drafting low, and they have LeBron and Anthony Davis, and so you're going to be capped out, and you're drafting low if you're drafting at all, if you haven't traded away picks. Whereas the Cavs, because LeBron left, got high picks, and a couple of them have worked out. Garland and Mobley in particular, and they made an opportunistic trade to pick up Jared Allen, which was a really smart deal by them. I thought the Rubio deal was a really smart deal by them. I mean, like that... It's funny because I don't remember if you and I talked about this or if it was, or maybe it was when I was on Cleveland radio, like last week. Like in the not so distant past, there was talk about whether or not that front office was going to be fired, whether they were going to, you know, clear it out again, fire Kobe Altman and his crew because they were under fire for where the Cavs were in over the last couple of years in the wake of LeBron's departure and the Kevin Love extension that has been such a albatross for them and everything else. But
and Colin Sexton's kind of polarizing because he's up for that contract extension
and Sexton and Garland weren't fitting well, and you know, Okoro has been so like
Garland can play. Like Garland is a player. Like I've watched a couple of his games this season. He's a really good player. Mobley is like he is what AD was. Like he is legit. Maybe even better in some ways, especially when it comes to contesting 3-point shots. Like he's everywhere on that. You put a little bit more muscle on him the next few years, he's going to be dynamite. He's going to be really dangerous. And if you have to trade Jared Allen to move Mobley to five, it's a pretty manageable contract in today's NBA. Like you could move Jared Allen pretty quickly.
Jared Allen's great. Half the teams in the league, if not more, would want Jared Allen. So I don't think there's any issue at all if you decided to move on from him. But yeah, I mean, look, if LeBron were just looking on paper and we're picking between two teams in free agency right now, and on the one hand, you know, the one team has Anthony Davis,
crazy,
but the other team has Jared Allen and Evan Mobley and Garland and Rubio and all these guys, like. I like that is the more attractive overall roster, I think, is Cleveland's. Does Anthony Davis at his best trump all of that? You know, you can make that argument, but the problem is the Lakers still have all these other issues, you know, the Westbrook fit and age issues and everything else. And look, that's the other unfair part of this, right? The Lakers are built older because they're contending and needed to go a certain route and wanted veterans. And so if you're talking about a 3 or 5 year window, all these guys are going to be retired. Like Carmelo's going to be gone and Ariza's going to be gone. And,
even 3 years.
It's an inherently unfair question, but it is a fun discussion. Yes, of course. But again, of course, Cleveland is better set up than the Lakers right now for a 3 to 5 year window. Because LeBron left and dropped them into the lottery. And if you're in the lottery enough times, you should come away with a franchise player or two.
You got to be excited if you're Cleveland, though. If nothing else, yeah. You got Mobley, you got Garland. Those are two guys that I think you can be pretty sure about. I don't know what they do with Sexton. That's going to be a challenge for Kobe Altman. I personally, he wants max money. I wouldn't do it. I don't think he and Garland make a lot of sense long term.
No.
So if you can find a trade that brings back, you know, pieces that make more, even if it's 75 cents on the dollar, pieces that make sense around those two guys, those are the two guys I'd be building around. Those two guys. And that's not a bad place to be if you're Cleveland, which hasn't been good in non-LeBron years, like since Brad Daugherty was there, like basically. Like it's, you got to go way back to find successful Cleveland teams. Howard, good stuff, man. As always, we'll do it again next week.
Always a pleasure, my friend.